Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The inner game is the relationship we have to our authentic purpose and contribution in life. It's about the ways that we grow personally and spiritually on the inside that affects everything on the outside of our lives. The quality of our inner game exerts a creative impact in the world. Because our quantum world shifts to reflect our thoughts and feelings, each of our contributions is critical to the quality of what's possible for us all on the planet. These are conversations with people who are up to something evolutionary in their lives, and an opportunity to hear about how these people take on their spiritual and personal growth, and how that strengthens their organizations and offerings to make a bigger difference. Our guest today is Calla Rose Ostrander, who has served as the City of San Francisco's Climate Change Projects Manager, and for the past 3 years, she has directed the Carbon Project for the People, Food, and Land Foundation, a hugely effective compost-based process that draws down carbon from the atmosphere and uses it to regenerate soil. And this is not just a project. She is producing and leading a movement with far-reaching benefits across many sectors. Thanks so much for joining me today, Calla Rose.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could just give us, I know there's no brief way to really talk about the Carbon Project, but maybe, you know, say something about the impact that it's having so people can really understand the far-reaching benefits of it.
Sure. Well, the Marin Carbon Project, the model from which I've drawn from for the past 5 years, started in Marin, California, with the discovery that a one-time application of a quarter inch of compost has an ongoing annual carbon sink in rangelands, grazed rangelands in California. The group that surrounded this work called themselves the Marin Carbon Project, and they created a model to help scale up this finding into practice. Now, that model includes things like working with technical assistance providers at the USDA, the folks who teach the farmers how to do new practices, and with scientists to help continue to discover all the details about this new principle in the soil system that was they found. One thing that's important to note is that prior to the science that the Marin Carbon Project did, we didn't really understand that you could move atmospheric carbon, so that excess carbon that's causing global warming, into the soil in a stable form in such a rapid period of time. We previously thought that soil carbon cycled pretty regularly into the soil and back out again. So the scientific community hadn't considered rangeland or grassland soils as potential carbon sinks. Now, the research from the Marin Carbon Project, as well as subsequent research from other areas around the world, has showed that soil carbon can actually be accrued and stored in longer-term storage areas or types of carbon within the soil. So it can be protected and stick around longer. Now, that has a really wide-reaching impact because suddenly there's a brand-new carbon sink, so to speak.
Right.
We know that forests take up carbon, but we didn't really understand that soils could also store a huge amount of carbon.
And that it was so beneficial. I mean, talk maybe just a little bit about the impacts for regenerative agriculture.
Right. So more carbon in the soil, unlike more carbon in the atmosphere, is good for us. It helps the soil to hold more water, and it creates an environment where the microorganisms in the soil can live and eat, thus attracting more nutrients. So plants that are grown in healthy soil not only have access to more water, they also have access to more nutrients, which means that the plants themselves are more nutrient-dense. And the soil microbiology is also healthier and happier. And that actually turns out is really important for humans because our gut biome is largely influenced by the health of the soil biome that we're eating our food or where our food is coming from. So there are far-reaching beneficial impacts. So both the farmer, they save by not spending so much on water and synthetic inputs for nutrients, but also for the human or the animal that's eating the produce or vegetables or grass that's grown off of that landscape, because those products are more nutrient-rich.
Was there a moment when you really started to understand the bigness of this? Do you remember kind of that feeling of like, wow, this is huge?
Yeah, thank you. That's such a great question. And I totally have an answer for it. In my position with the City and County of San Francisco, I had watched the Marin Carbon Project for several years. John Wick, the co-founder, that had actually called me about a year or two into their work and told me that they were going to create carbon credits for rangelands and asked me a bunch of questions, and I'd answered it to him and explained to him, you know, how we invested in carbon mitigation and that likely his project would not qualify for the standards that we had. And it was really amazing because they turned around and not only did they produce incredible science, they have more than a dozen papers that were published in peer-reviewed journals. They also produced an entire framework for supporting the farmer and government and the consumer and brands and how to roll this out on the landscape. And I remember thinking at some point, I've never seen a group do their homework so well. I was just really impressed. And when I understood that, you know, you could take something that was causing a lot of high-intensity greenhouse gases, like methane, so waste, and turn that into something that not only prevented that methane from happening, composting produces far fewer emissions than landfilling, and that you could then, so you're reducing your emissions, and then you're also creating a product that helps sequester carbon, but not just carbon, it also helps regulate your water cycles, it cools your soil down, it enhances the functioning of the microclimate, so it creates resilience to climate change, resilience to extreme weather, resilience to drought. And it just sort of struck me that the solution was the most simple and also the most far-reaching of any that I'd ever seen. The framework that the members of the Marin Carbon Project built up around deploying it was really, really very impressive. So at that point in time, I decided that this was what I was going to put my time towards. This is what I was going to devote the next phase of my life to.
It just makes me happy hearing you describe all of the benefits of it. Something I spend a lot of time helping my own clients to develop is their why. Why they do the work they do on behalf of the human species and all life on the planet. And I'm finding it's something we all need to give meaning to our lives right now. And I'm just wondering if you could share some of your why.
It's hard to interrogate that. You know, you're thinking about it. I've always been this way for as long as I can remember. I've wanted to help the planet and help people and heal the planet. I really love people, and I really love plants and animals, and I had a deep sensitivity to them and us all as a child. And so in third grade, I decided I was going to help try to save the rainforest. And I don't know, it's just been that way my whole life. I think my dedication to the planet and the people and all the life forms on it has really been with me forever. And so I think that's why I'm here. I think it's the why that shaped my entire you know, life as an active human in this world, in addition to, of course, all the relationships that go along with that. And I think the why would also be part of my answer, would be partly about relationships. I mean, I love them. I love people, and it's really good to be in good relationship with people, or with your garden, or with the animals that are part of your life. It feels really good, and so I'm definitely very motivated by the benefits that one gets when there's harmony in relationships and productivity and growth. And you know, that doesn't mean everything is perfect all the time, but I think a big part of my why is, you know, I love really good food that's grown in a good way, that's by people who are happy and animals that are happy. It feels good. It tastes good. I want to live in that world. So my why is very much about the relationships that I love and want to cultivate and get joy from. So.
And I just want to take a quick break and say this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. And my guest today is Calla Rose Ostrander. And you brought up you know, your early education. And I know you were educated in a Waldorf school from kindergarten through high school. And that's really significant to me, especially since we know that how we're educating our children is so important to the quality of our future. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact of your Waldorf education. You've shared with me that you don't think you could be doing what you're doing today without it. Tell us a little bit about that.
First of all, I think it's just so important, regardless of the educational system that one chooses to put your children in, is to be outside. I think a huge influence for me was the amount of time I spent outdoors, both with adults during the summer and children and my friends, but also in school, and really learning what it means to be outside, to be part of the world, to be part of a group of people. And I think that is where, in particular, Waldorf was helpful, that this idea that you you learn through observation, right? That you're really learning to see the whole thing. I remember this exercise where we went out and watched a sprout grow. You know, and every day you kind of watch its growth, and then you mimic that growth with movement, and then you draw that growth from the seed to the root to the sprouting plant to the flowering plant. You know, this sort of the phenomenology of Goethe and how it's woven into the Steiner education really taught me to see, to step back and to look at both the thing itself, but the system context that thing is in, the context that the plant is in. The sun is part of that context. When it opens its leaves, it's driven by that context of the sunshine, you know, and water and air. And I think that observation, or that central principle of observation, is really fundamental to how I work in the world. And people talk a lot about systems theory and systems design, or whole systems design. And that definitely was a part of my education later in life, but I think my foundation very much comes from this early teaching and, adherence to observation, to observation throughout seasons, to seasonal change, to relational changes. And I think that Waldorf gave me, which is really important, well, two things. One is it gave me a family of people that I will have my whole life, and it also gave me the trust and understanding of how to work with groups of people even when you don't get along. So more of a cooperative rather than a competitive standpoint of how to be in the world. You know, the lack of competition really meant that we were required to cooperate, and that it wasn't about me being better than other folks. It was about, you know, me doing the best that I can and doing it the way that works for me, while also participating in and being part of a larger group. Now, I can't say I'm perfect and definitely a human, and so it's not like I trust absolutely everyone or that everyone is worthy of trust. But I think that this context of, you know, what does consensus mean? It doesn't necessarily look like what you would find at, like, a progressive rally in terms of consensus. It really means, like, working with and understanding or attempting to understand other folks and where they're coming from, and then trusting them enough to support them, knowing that they will then in turn be around to support you. So, again, it's not perfect and highly fraught, as all relationships are, but I think that this direction towards cooperation and consensus versus competition was really, really huge, because it created space for me to see that there are ways in which we all win.
Right.
And to really search for those ways instead of just to search for the way for me to win. So I think that the cooperation versus competition was really central to how I do my work. And also, of course, the pursuit of beauty. I mean, I think above all else, Waldorf really inspires a desire for beauty in the individual and a desire to serve and create beauty in the world. And so that can manifest in a bunch of different ways, but certainly that beauty as a guiding principle has been very fundamental to both my personal life and my work.
That piece about competition and cooperation, I feel like in our in our educational system, there's such an emphasis, even if it's just implicit, on being right, instead of maintaining the integrity of the group. And I see that play out in so many professional and social and community venues. And I wonder if you can remember how that was approached in your education. You know, that piece of having the quality and the integrity of the group or the class be as important as you know, understanding some whatever it is that you're trying to understand.
Well, I'm not a Waldorf educator, and I haven't read much of Steiner, so I don't think I can really speak to what that looks like from a philosophical or, you know, right, curricular standpoint. I guess what I can say is I remember sitting in a lot of circles and having to talk things out and doing a lot of activities outdoors, like GLOPES courses or games that required group cooperation, and, you know, having those groups break down or circles break down, but just having to sit there with it, you know, like having to sit in the mess of it and sit in the imperfection of it. And I don't really know, like, where did this come from, but I have a lot of memories of, like, you know, group tasks or sitting in circle for class meetings and having a teacher help facilitate a dialogue. And maybe that dialogue didn't always work. And I certainly remember times when it did not work. And I remember times when, you know, I was the cause of the need for that dialogue, or someone else was, or I didn't know how to say what I needed. And definitely I'm not, you know, again, this is not a claim of perfection, but I remember being trained and then therefore a much more comfortable sort of sitting in the mess of it, you know, sitting in the uncomfortableness. And even just getting to the point where, you know, bringing people into the room when there is tension and knowing that there is a way through that tension. And it doesn't mean that every one person's going to be right, but it does mean that we can find commonalities and that, you know, we can at least have a chance to speak what we need. And I think that permission to speak what you need, you know, whether you do it or not, is important. And so, yeah, I guess just a lot of circles,
yeah.
A lot of forced class meetings and group activities. And again, this is not necessarily something that's like really philosophically beautiful. It's pretty messy, you know, the human relationship. But the dynamic is that in the end, you know, I think you can see it in my class. We all really love each other, and there's differences. You know, not everybody is as close as some folks are, but at the end of the day, we all trust each other still and are each other's extended family and rejoice in seeing each other. And I think that human experience is really, really powerful.
Absolutely. It feels like that's kind of where we're at on the planet right now, just sitting in the mess of it. And having to...
Well, I hope we can sit in the mess of it. I think we're actually not quite there yet.
Yeah, that's true.
People are afraid to sit in the mess of it.
That's true.
You know, people feel like, well, I have to have the perfect answer or the perfect solution, or we have to decide how we're all going to do it. And if we can't decide on it, it's not good enough, then we'll, you know, we'll wait for the next big thing, and that'll be good enough. And, you know, climate change will be a big enough thing for us to rally behind. So I don't really think we're there yet. I think we're getting there, but it's the willingness to, like, sit in your imperfection, to know that you're not right. And, you know, I definitely think I'm right a lot of the time. Right? So it's like, you know, it's also just the ability to, like, have some sense of humor and forgiveness for yourself and others, and allow and invite conversation in a way that is not passive aggressive, that doesn't cause emotional injury, right? So I don't think we're quite there sitting in the mess of it yet. I think a lot of people are still looking for the perfect way to sit in the mess. And the reality is you just have to sit in it.
When I asked you earlier about what you struggle with, you know, I wanted to bring that up because I think it's so important for us. This is part of us being able to get to where we can sit in the mess of what is, you know, happening right now, and be able to be to access enough wholeness in ourselves to then access enough creativity to find the ways forward. And, you know, and I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's just so important for us to hear each other being real about the things that are difficult and yet still are instructive to us in being creative and finding those creative contributions.
So last week I had a meeting that lasted about 3 hours and it ended up being very productive. But going into that, there was a little bit of tension on both sides. And, you know, the two different groups that I was hosting for this meeting, for this project that we're doing, have had some historic tension. Certainly their sense of, you know, how they do things is very different. And there was a little bit of concern about resources. So there was a feeling of resource scarcity. Like, was there going to be enough money? You know, who's going to do what? Does it make sense to do this together? And both leaders expressed their sort of fear of this tension to me. And what I asked them to do before coming to the meeting was I said, come with exactly what it is you need. Like, don't try to fit what you need into what you think the other person can or can't do. Just come and say exactly how you see this going, and it's like perfect world, highest best self potential. You know, tell me what your vision is and tell me what you need, and be prepared to share that with the group. And so we started, you know, after introductions, we started off by I modeled that and said, you know, here's what I need. This is what the donors need. This is a project that has been, funding has been offered for, but in order for that funding to come, we really have to have these goals. You know, my goal today is to help facilitate this process, whatever. And then the two other leaders shared their vision. And at that point, you know, what was amazing was that they both felt really like they had space to say what they needed, and what they thought this project could be. It's a very large, potentially impactful project. And so, you know, that resulted in then me being like, okay, great. So as you describe to me what you need, I now get to write an outline of what the contents of this project could look like. What are the different pieces of it? And then let's write that up. Oh, and then who is going to do them? Or, you know, which, let's break them down a little bit more. Like, let's get into this one. We know this one's really hairy. Let's unpack it. Let's unpack what we all think should be in this and what we think should not be in this. And, you know, and then 2 hours later, we have got three whiteboards full of a beautiful brainstorm that resulted in, you know, from a very creative process where people felt free to say what they needed and what their expertise was. And I also was able to call on folks, you know, who I'd talked to prior to coming and say, you know, I know that you have a background in this. Can you describe how that discipline would do this? Or I know that your expertise is in this. What are your concerns about this? So by me knowing the people who are coming into that room and their goals and their expertise and then holding a big vision, we were able to move from tension into a space where people felt they had room to move and room to grow, which then created a space for creativity. And we walked out the other side with a very impressive, you know, result. And I think that speaks to the willingness of the folks in the room to go there with me, you know, and the trust that we have from working together for the past 5 years. Well, they haven't worked together, but I've worked with them. And so, you know, I think part of that messiness is establishing, part of getting people to sit down when they are uncomfortable is establishing trust, you know, and that's a really vulnerable place to be, especially for me, because if there's something I've done accidentally or on purpose or because I'm bullheaded or whatever and you don't trust me, I'm not going to be able to do my work well.
Right.
On the other hand, if we are able to trust each other and, like, talk through the things that come up, work out what is needed or when we get hurt or what goes wrong in miscommunication, then on the other side of it, we're going to be very productive and creative because we're going to feel free. You know, because when we trust somebody, we really feel free. And that's where creativity can really come into play.
Oh, thank you. That's a beautiful place to end since we do need to wrap up. But thank you for sharing your process and and just who you are with us today, Calla Rose. Really lovely to have you as a guest.
Thanks so much for asking those questions.
Yeah, you bet. If you have a question for Calla Rose or me, you can join the Facebook page at The Inner Game, and we can continue the conversation there. Until next time, trust yourself and try as best that you can to create a place where people can trust themselves.